forget the body, which is part of what constitutes a human being. It's feeling, it's memory and perception, and basically what sets the scene for the understanding of the sense phenomenon that you experience by the five senses. Then there is mental concoctions, which is basically your thought process, your feelings and your emotions. The first lot of feelings is simply happiness, sadness, pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral feelings. But what I mean by mental concoctions is if you like something, you don't like it, you think about it, and you have moods about it, you get angry, you like it, you want to more of it. And then finally, consciousness. But consciousness here is not a permanent thing. Consciousness arises and passes away. And it arises and passes away so fast, that most people's meditation, even those who practice a long meditation, can't actually catch it. But because you can't catch it, it seems as though it's unconscious or subconscious. But actually, it just means that your mind's not fast enough to catch it. From a Buddhist perspective, you can only be conscious of one sense object at a time. So you can only see one thing, you can't hear it at the same time. But there are literally millions and millions and millions of moments of consciousness in the blink of an eye. So it appears as if you can hear things and see things at the same time and basically live in the world, understanding the experiences that you have. And what you call subconscious just simply means that your mindfulness isn't sharp enough and concentration is not so sharp enough to be able to catch it. But if you can sharpen your mindfulness and sharpen your concentration, then you can actually get to a stage where you can see moments of consciousness arising and passing away. Not everybody can, not everybody does. It depends on your personality. But basically, there's that mental energy. So all conditioned phenomena arise and pass away. And what you know, what you think about, what you would say would be things that you mull over in your subconscious, all start from some sort of sensory contact. And by sensory contact, I mean six senses. So things that you think about as well, the mind being the sixth sense. So you take that on board, and sometimes you're not even aware that you're mulling something over. And that's simply because your mindfulness is not there, your concentration's not there. But from a Buddhist perspective, you're still conscious of it. Consciousness still knows that. And it's then interesting because when you look at what I was talking about last week, which was really the body and the pain that's associated with the body, when we're attached to it, you say, well, okay, let's forget the body, because, yep, we agree that it's just elements, just a bag of stardust. So then what is it that's attached to that? Well, it's this nama dharma. There is attachment that arises because of the way that we perceive the world. And the way that we perceive the world causes us to like some things, some experiences, and causes us to dislike some experiences and some, we don't really care too much one way or another. But because we like some things and we dislike others, that assessment of us, of whatever we experience through our senses, is something that then drives the way we think, and the way that we behave, and the way that we speak. Because things that we like, we want to keep. And things that we don't like, we want to offload. Unfortunately, all the things that we experience by the senses, any sense, whether it's the mind sense, touch, sight, hearing, taste, all of those are conditioned. They all are conditioned phenomena. They arise because of something. And we can't control that something. We can try, and we do have some limited control in what we do. We could sit like this and we could experience pain. And then we could say, well, I'll just get up and move, and that gets rid of the pain. Well, it does, but all that it does is it shifts it from one time to another. The actual attachment to the pain is still there. The way that you perceive it will be the same the next time round. It will be unpleasant and you don't want it, so you want to move away from it. Things that you like a nice view or a pleasant sound, some music, that you want to be attached to, that you want to say, then that's really nice. Now I can hold on to that because that's something pleasant. That's something which gives me pleasure. But when the music stops, or the view disappears, or gets vandalized, or whatever, changes, because that's its nature, then your source of happiness is gone too. If you place happiness in somebody else, for example, a relationship that you have, when that person dies, and they will die, how does that make you feel? Happy or sad? But you can't control that. So if you put your happiness into them, then you're asking for trouble, because they will die. If you put happiness, your happiness is based on this body, let's go even closer to home, forget about all the outside stimuli, you need this body to be able to experience them. So you want this body in tip-top condition because you want to see, you want to hear, you want to feel. But this body is going to break down too.
Know all about that.
Yeah, and so where does that leave you? If your whole happiness is based on having this body do experience things for you, then you're in trouble at some stage, because birth, old age, or birth, aging, sickness and death catch up with all of us. You know, once we're born, we're going to age. You can't stop it. You can't have any baby. There's no baby born into this world that suddenly decides, I'm not going to grow anymore. There isn't one. They grow. They age. When they die, no one knows. But they will die. And during the time of their life, they will experience some pain and suffering. Because that's just the nature of life. You're born into this world, you'll age, you'll suffer pain, and you'll die. They're the certainties of life. And it's this attachment to that process which actually causes us to have all sorts of homemade problems, if you like. But if we can let go of those things, if we can examine the body for what it is, and we can examine that attachment to it that the mind has, then we can start to unravel the illusion that there is some form of happiness, some form of pleasantry within this day-to-day, everyday world which we see around us. From a Buddhist perspective, the world that we see around us is basically a construction. It's something that the mind concocts. It's something which is just a natural phenomenon, but we construct it and make it into the world that we see. But not everybody sees the world the same way. Not everyone shares the same experience. For example, two people can have roughly the same experience. One likes it and one doesn't. It's subjective. There's no objective understanding of an experience. Some people like a nice piece of art. Some people say it's rubbish, should be thrown in the bin. Different opinions. There's nothing objective there. We judge things. And that's what that's the way of this world. It's the world of supposition, if you like. We make things up. This chair doesn't say it's a chair. It doesn't say whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable. It's just a piece of cloth, piece of wood, put together. The cloth doesn't even know the wood's there. But we do. So we're conscious of this, and we say, that's a chair, and it's got arms, and it's sit down, it's got cloth on it. We make things up. When you're born into this world, no one says your name's Bill, apart from your parents. You don't come out and say, I'm Bill, you know, from day one, do you? You don't come out when you're born and say, no, I'm Bill. You don't say you're a male. You don't say you're female. You don't say boo to a goose. But you start to grow and you start to look at these people who are around you, and then suddenly one of them's there saying, oh, mama, mama, and another one's there saying, no, I'm dada, dada, say dada before mama. Dada, say, yeah. No, because you're making it up as you go along. These are the influences that you have. So you learn it. These are now getting conditioned into you. So this is what, when the teachers talk about the world of supposition, this is what they're talking about. When they talk about the world as a natural world, it is what it is. The elements are what they are, but we get attached to them. And the way that we get attached to them is what causes us to experience suffering. Because we don't want the unpleasant experiences, but we do want the very pleasant ones. And so this clinging, this wanting for happiness, this search for happiness in the outside world, with the mind constantly going out through the senses, constantly trying to bring back stimuli to vet them, to see which is the happy one, which is the unhappy one, which do I like, which don't I like. The ones that you don't like can cause then all sorts of problems, because you can get angry. This is what defiles the mind, the way of normal human beings. This is how we behave. Things that we don't like, we can get angry about, for example. Things that we don't like, we want to throw away. Things that we do like, we want to accumulate. So we become greedy. We become angry. We have what are called defilements.
Can I just stop you there for a second? So it's not by coincidence, last night at the session at Rolling Stone, I put forward the question, what do you insure when you take out a life insurance policy? And the reason why, the answer of course is that you ensure not if you're going to die, because everybody knows they're going to die, it's when you're going to die, your insurance. But what about right and wrong? Is that the same then?
Right and wrong?
Yeah.
No. Right and wrong? There is a right and wrong, but it's right and wrong based on what outcomes there are. So, for example, if you have goodwill towards people, that's a good, right thing to do. If you're a moral person, you practice 5 precepts, you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't tell lies, you abstain from unsuitable sexual conduct. If you keep the precepts, that's a good thing. If you break the precepts, you go killing them. You go killing beings, and you're telling lies, and you're causing all sorts of troubles with people. That's simply, it's not right or wrong in the sense of the typical way that you understand it, but it will produce bad results for you. What it will do, if you do something which is good, is it will accumulate merit. It will accumulate merit in the sense that, we're talking about karma, basically. So the law of karma basically says if you do wholesome things, you will get a wholesome result. And if you do unwholesome things, you'll get an unwholesome result. So you judge whether it's right or wrong. Really irrelevant from the point of view of understanding. You don't label it right or wrong. You label it whether it's going to have a good outcome for you or it's going to have a bad outcome for you. And so the good outcomes were basically explained by the Buddha. That's what the Dharma is. It's a pathway to lead beings to freedom from suffering. So once you understand that the world is suffering, then the first thing that you a smart person wants to do is to say, okay, well, what causes that? Because if I want to get rid of suffering, I have to get rid of the cause. Cause and effect. One of the main... there are basically five laws that are universal through every universe that there's ever been. The 5 niyamas. One of them is basically the science of physics and what we would call these days physics and chemistry. Yeah. The second one is what we would call basically today genetics. So if you plant a mango seed, you'll get a mango tree. You don't plant an acorn and get a sycamore tree. You plant an acorn and get an oak tree. And so that's the second one. The third one is the law of karma. So it's the law of cause and effect. So if you develop good causes, wholesome causes, you get wholesome results. If you develop unwholesome causes, that is, you get angry, you are greedy, you have ill will towards people, you break your precepts. These are the sorts of things that are going to steer you in the wrong direction. If you go around maiming, killing people, bad karma, not good karma. even from the point of view of having ill will towards people who are doing you bad or doing you ill will, is itself not following the path of the Dharma. You're supposed to have goodwill to everybody, even a mass murderer. The idea is to have compassion for them. There's a story that I like of a Tibetan monk. Some of you may have heard this. If you have, then I apologise for telling it again. But he was arrested by the Chinese back in the 60s, I think it was, when he was arrested originally. He was kept in prison for many, many years, and he was tortured and beaten and generally badly treated. And eventually they let him go. And he made his way to the Dalai Lama in India. And he paid his respects to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama was very pleased to see him. And the Dalai Lama said to this monk, he said, during your incarceration, were you ever really afraid? And the monk thought about it. And he said, yes, there was times when I was really afraid. And the Dalai Lama said, well, what were you afraid of? And he said, I was afraid that I would lose compassion for my captors. Mm-hmm. So if someone who's undergoing that amount of torture can still be compassionate for his torturers, then what must we do? People who get angry at us, we shouldn't show anger back. If we're practicing properly, we should let mindfulness catch us having that unwholesome thought of wanting to be angry, and then turn it and say, oh no, I'm going to have, this is an opportunity to really practice goodwill. It's easy to practice goodwill when everybody's nice to you. Hmm? The real talent is to practice when they're not nice to you.
Sorry, you had five. Did you get up to four?
Five precepts?
Yeah.
Five laws.
I went to karma. The other two. No, I've got to three. Karma. We're talking about karma.
Sorry.
Yeah. The fourth one is what we call citta. Again, this is a word that I used last week, and it's a word which is useful to understand if you're trying to understand the Dharma. It doesn't translate well into English, and it has several connotations to it. But what I was talking about before, in terms of feelings, perceptions and memory, thoughts and concocting things, and consciousness, the way that that works, one definition of the citta is that how that works with the senses. So as a sense object comes in via the eye, so you see an eyesight, for example, then how you react to that, that's one definition of the citta. But that's a citta which is governed by desire. It's not a pure citta. It's a citta which is attached to this outside world. It's a citta which is attached and lives within this world of supposition, this world that we construct that I was talking about earlier. And in itself, it's muddled in the sense that it's polluted. It's polluted by things like greed, hatred, delusion, ignorance. And that pollution is what causes basically the whole process of life, including birth, aging, suffering. It's that attachment that the citta has. It's the when this body breaks down and dies, and we take rebirth. From a Buddhist perspective, we believe in karma and rebirth. While there's no being, there's no central entity, there's no self, this perpetuation of causes and effects, that does go on. And all that happens is one body disappears and another one takes its place. And consciousness, if you like, can transfer between one and the other. When you die, the last conscious moment that you have, whatever that sense object is that you're conscious of, and it's usually a mental object, will be the first object that enters the next lifetime. And so there's a connection between birth, between death and rebirth. So the way that the citta operates will be the same no matter which universe you're in, no matter which time scale you're on. When this universe collapses and a new one takes its place and there are more human beings, the citta will work in exactly the same way. It's a universal law, just like cause and effect, karma. And the fifth one is dharma. Dharma is consistent. The dharma that the Lord Buddha taught, he discovered the dharma. He didn't invent it. The dharma is always there. It's always constant. The way the world works and the way your mind works and how it interacts with the world, it's universal. It'll be there in the next aeon and the following aeon, and it's been there for countless aeons before this one. And so when you understand the dharma, then you'll realize that you'll see that the dharma itself, what we call dharma, is in fact a multivalent word. It's got lots of different meanings in different contexts, and one of them is just the natural world. Everything is dharma, whether it's this world, whether it's a celestial realm, whether it's the way that the mind works, it's all dharma. But there is a specific use of the word dharma, and that is the teachings of the Lord Buddha. Because he taught, his awakening was, he woke up to the fact that dharma is this. That this is the way the world works. This is why we experience suffering. And if we experience suffering because of this, and we break the cause, then we get free from suffering. And the way to do that is the Eightfold Path. So the Four Noble Truths were really the first teaching of the Lord Buddha. But there will be noble truths whatever era. It's just a case of whether there's anyone there to actually understand what the Four Noble Truths are. When there's a Buddha around, he understands. And if he's a self-enlightened Buddha and teaches others, then he will teach others. If he's a Pachekya Buddha, silent Buddha, then he keeps it all the knowledge to himself. So he becomes enlightened, but he doesn't teach anybody. But someone like the last Buddha teaches others. But he can, one of those kind of Buddhas, Sammasam Buddha, they can only arise when there's no Dharma in the world left. So everyone's forgotten it. No one knows it. It's still there to be discovered, and what he does or she does is discover it, find it, and then teach it again. And there have been lots of Buddhas in the past, and there will be lots more in the future.
Stephen, can I just say that in the last 10 to 10 minutes, it's been so enlightening. You told me so much in that time ago, it's been, my mind is just going, but you've been speaking so literally, and it, like you said, it's not prepared, it's not, and yet it's so rewarding. Really was good.
Well, that wasn't my talk. I haven't started the talk yet.
But just to give you some feedback, extremely effective. The last 10, 15 minutes has been like, wow.
Yeah. It seems that, from my point of view, being a layperson, maybe you're able to communicate it better than some of the monks that... Maybe it's because I've only experienced two or three different months teaching, maybe that's it. But what I wanted to ask was, with the Dharma, it's for everybody, but is it hard to live the Dharma in as a lay person as opposed to a monk?
Yes,
because it's sort of like the Dharma's designed for a monk. It's sort of, you know, but it's like,
There's an element of that. There's also an element that it's harder to practice the further away you get from the time of the Buddha, because the teachings get diluted, and they have been diluted, and you can find lots of different Buddhist sects that will all tell you something slightly different. What I do when I talk from my own practice, or I talk from what my teachers have taught me. I don't speak from books, and I don't, you know, I apologise to anyone who may be a scholar, because some of the things that I say may not be exactly what you'll read in a book on Buddhism, but that's because that's not where I come from. My background is practice. My background is studying some of the what I consider to be the best teachers, and I've spent many years with them. So I look at it from a practical perspective. So now that I'm a layperson, then yeah, it's not as easy, because one of the things I was going to do this evening was simply to get people to reflect on why they want to practice meditation. Why have they come? Why are you here? What do you want out of meditation? Not just tonight, but in general. Just think about that for a second. Close your eyes and think about that. Now, not everyone will want the same thing. Some people will want to come because they want to be calm. They want to practice calmness. Some people will come because they've heard that they can perhaps learn about mindfulness and maybe practice a little bit of mindfulness, and they've heard that that's good for whatever reason. Some people might come because they want to learn a little bit of Dharma, and they want to practice and they want to improve the amount of good karma or merit that they have so that they can improve their next rebirth. Some people might come because they want to be enlightened. All of those reasons are fine. They're all fine. People go at their own pace. And we shouldn't be judgmental about whether one's better than the other. But they will produce different results.
If we'd all like to be enlightened, but a lot of us have probably given up getting there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
this lifetime.
But, and so as a layperson, that weighs on you. You have responsibilities as a layperson. You have fewer as a monk. That's the whole reason why people ordain as monks, so that they can have fewer responsibilities and spend more time practicing. But as a layperson, you have to try and work your way through and do what you can. And when you look at all of those reasons for wanting to meditate, they have one thing in common, and that is you want to take control of your mind. You want to take control of the way that you respond to external stimuli. It doesn't matter whether you want to be calm, whether you want to investigate and become wise, or whether you want to be mindful. You want to be able to control your mind. That's what meditation does. You can think about it in a way that the untrained mind, with mindfulness, trains, or the mind with mindfulness trains the untrained mind. This is really a way of looking at it. So mindfulness becomes the key. If you're not mindful of what's going on, the way you think, the way you feel, the way you respond, the way you speak, the way you act, and the way you think, if you're not mindful of what you're doing there, then you're not in control of whether you're making good karma or bad karma. Sometimes you respond because it's simply an immediate reaction, you know, because you're trained. And I'll give you an example of that. If you practice morality and you keep your precepts and you don't kill things, you don't have to think twice about whether you're going to step on a spider. You just don't do it. It's just automatic. It just happens. But not every act that you do, not every word that you speak, comes with such mindfulness. But that's what precepts do. Precepts are like setting a policy. If you're in corporate affairs or you're in a business, you have policies, so you know when a certain thing arises, you've got a policy to deal with it. There are protocols in place. Morality at that level of precepts is the same. So you don't think, it doesn't even enter your mind that you're going to tell a lie. You're just truthful. You don't have to think about it, well, shall I lie here, or maybe bend the truth a bit here. It's just, no. you don't do it because you're keeping your precepts and it's not something that you have to think about. But there are other aspects of life as a layperson that you really do have to think about. And whether you, the degree to which you practice those will help determine how your meditation goes. Because if you practice in a way which turns away from sensual pleasure and looking to gain satisfaction through what you see, what you hear, what you taste, what you feel, then you start to gain some benefit. So you shouldn't think you come along to a meditation session and then you come in the door and you're going to control your senses and you're going to sit and be calm and then you're going to walk out the door and then suddenly everything's back to normal again. Because you, when you go and you walk out the door and if you fall back into that trap, you've just lost all the benefits that you've just gained. Meditation is something you can do every single waking moment of the day if you're mindful. Everything can be a learning experience. Everything that confronts you, you have an opportunity to respond to, whether it's the way that you behave, whether it's what you say, or whether it's what you think. You can be in control. You can be in charge. So you can determine whether you're going to be hateful towards someone or whether you're going to be compassionate towards them. Your choice. Which gives the better result? Well, the Buddha said that the better result is given if you're compassionate towards them. So the smart person then, who wants to improve their store of merit, they're compassionate and they do the right thing. Those that are unwise do the opposite. They practice ill will and they receive the karma accordingly. And their practice becomes harder. Because then when they walk through the door and they come and say, I want to practice meditation, so I can sit there, they can sit cross-legged all they like. But if their mind isn't where it should be, then they're not meditating. They're just simply sitting on a chair or sitting on the floor. So meditation is an attitude of mind, but it's not an attitude that just you start when you walk in the door and finish when you walk out. Meditation is something that you have the opportunity to do all the time. So the first thing is keeping five, for a layperson, keeping five precepts. So you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't tell lies, you don't have intoxicating drugs, and you don't participate in the kind of sexual activity which will lead to unwholesomeness. So you don't commit adultery, you don't have sex with minors and all of that sort of stuff. You're monogamous, or you abstain. So that's the basic precepts. Over and above that, there are lots of ways that the Buddha explained how lay people can behave. For example, he said that there are six ways that lead to ruin. So I'll take the negative first. Six ways that lead to ruin. First of all, drinking. That's all one of the precepts anyway, that you abstain from alcohol and you abstain from things which make the mind less than alert, shall we say. Sorry?
Heedless,
yes. Pramat in Thai. So heedless. So, because while you're drunk, you don't know what you're doing. You know, you can kill people driving in a car. You can be abusive to people and really not in control. The one thing that I've just said is that when you come through the store and you want to meditate, you want to control your mind. So how can anyone think that drinking and getting drunk is compatible with meditation? It just doesn't go. So that leads to ruin, bad karma.
Drugs is the same.
Sorry?
Drugs is the same.
Drugs the same. Anything that makes the mind heedless.
Including prescription drugs, or some prescription drugs, of course, but then.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take them, here's an interesting thing. If you take a drug because it's a medicine, even though it might make you heedless, you can take it. For example, when I was ordained, I had a bad stomach for a while, and under the rules, I was allowed to take opium. Because if you take a little bit of opium and you swallow it, it's actually very good for your stomach, and it doesn't actually send you crazy either. Because you're not smoking it, you're ingesting it, but through the digestive tract, and it's actually quite a good, it, taken in small doses, it's actually quite good for your stomach. So, you know, there are rules around it. It's not strict that you know, yes or no. If you can take something for pure medicinal purposes that you have an ailment that it will fix, then yes, you can. You can, under certain circumstances, take. But again, a lot depends on your own attitude, your own reason for doing something. Next thing that leads to heedlessness is staying out late at night. Now, bear in mind that these were rules that the Lord Buddha laid down 2,600 years ago. So staying out late at night, back in those days, going around villages and basically not being at home, no one knows where you are, leads to heedlessness. Why? Because people start talking, you know, where's all, what's he going, what's he been doing, oh, there's a bit of crime been done, so it must be him or it must be her. So not a good thing to be out roaming around late at night aimlessly. Especially, I mean, you think about these days, guys go curb crawling for prostitutes and that. Not a Buddhist practice, and something that will lead to bad karma. And going to clubs, pubs, nightclubs, those sorts of things. Going to see shows, and people say, well, you get to that part, and people go, oh, but I quite like a bit of, you know, music or whatever, and that's fine, you know. These are things which you, what I'm explaining now, there are, you can practice them at your own level. But if you really want to make a lot of progress with your own meditation or your own practice of Dharma, then you take them more seriously than not. And the reason why I'm saying, including shows, nightclubs, and all of that sort of thing, is because they rely on sensual pleasure. When you go to a club, you want to enjoy yourself. What do you mean by enjoyment? You want to have a drink, or you want to dance, or you want to do things, you want some music. Things which are, stir the senses. When you meditate, you do exactly the opposite. You want to control your senses and not respond in a way which is the way of the world. You want to be you want to understand how you react to sensory stimulation. When you go to places of entertainment and what haven't you, you're doing exactly the opposite. You're going because you want to see something, a nice show. You want to hear nice sounds. And that just adds to the delusion of what the world's really like. It doesn't add to the understanding of the world. But we do it because it's pleasurable and because, you know, we're lay people and we've had a job and it's a hard day. And if we sit down and meditate, our mind just won't focus, you know, just won't do it. So I'll go off and do something else. I'll listen to a bit of music because I know that if I listen to this piece of music, my mind will quieten down. And that's fine. Providing you understand what it is that you're doing. And then you take that opportunity and say, all right, well, I've listened to that piece of music. My mind's quietened down now. Now maybe I can turn my hand to meditation. Then you turn something which is not really totally beneficial into something that is beneficial. So again, it's how you live your life. It's how you understand what it is that you're doing by thought, speech, and mind, and action. Sorry. So, how far have I got? So next one, gambling. Yeah, no, gambling. How many times do you hear about people who are gambling addicts? I know someone who's just got out of prison because they gambled away lots of people's money. They worked in a bank, they embezzled their clients' money, and they spent 5 years in jail. How happy do you think they are? How happy do you think their family is? How happy do you think that their loved ones are, and people that they know? I can assure you that wasn't a pleasant experience when they were in jail, and I know the family, and it's not a pleasant experience for the children involved. But nevertheless, they did it because they were addicted to it. But gambling leads to ruin. So that's another thing that, from a Buddhist perspective, we don't do. So we don't go in the crown and have a little flutter, or we don't. If you're going to give to charity, and you know, Lotto or something like that, because they will do some good works with that, and you can look at that as giving to charity. If you think about it that way, and that's your intent, if you win some money, then fine. That's a little bit different. Again, nothing black and white, nothing absolutely concrete. And how you interpret that, that's a personal thing for yourself, whatever you're comfortable with.
You said, this is one interesting aspect you're just raising. How many of us drive cars and gamble every single time you drive a car? Because you take a risk.
I won't get caught.
You say, I have a choice. Sit here, be patient, wait my turn, or I'm going to gamble on doing this. And you do it all the time. And
that's a different form of gambling.
The sign said I could do that. Everything says, the law says I can do that. But deep down you know it's not right.
Well, from a Buddhist perspective, we try and make
you
common sense.
You don't go to a casino or anything to gamble. You do it every day you drive a car.
Yeah. But from a Buddhist perspective, what we try and do is to use common sense.
Let the other person
in. Yeah. Have compassion for them. If that spot is really that important to them, by all means, take it. Of course, it becomes a little bit difficult when you've let that person in and then they pull into their last space in the car park and you're in a busy hurry because you've got an appointment somewhere. And so now you've got the real opportunity to be angry with them and say, oh, I shouldn't have let them in. Or you can just say, oh, no, that's the way things are. C'est la vie, such is life. And again, be positive about the whole thing. So you can you have the choice. You can choose your own misery or choose your own happiness. Nothing I can do about it. You choose yourself. Which do you want to be, miserable or happy? All I can do is give you some idea as to what will lead to happiness and what will lead to misery. Next one. I don't want to lose count. having wrong acquaintances. So people who aren't on the same page as you when it comes to your own development. It makes things difficult. So if you know people who are always getting drunk, or you know people who are a bit shady characters, or if you associate too much with them, some of their characteristics may rub off on you. And so that's something. The Lord Buddha said one of the greatest blessings that you can have is to associate with wise people. If you associate with wise people, you'll learn things. If you associate with people who, let's say, of shady nature, then what you learn is not the right sort of lessons that you should be learning. And finally, the last thing that leads to ruin is not taking your work seriously. So you don't turn up for your job on time. You're not very nice to your employers. You don't take it seriously, you're not very productive. From a Buddhist perspective, what the Buddha said was that leads to ruin too, because your employer doesn't actually want to keep you. So if you lose your job, you can't provide for your family, and again, it leads to ruin. So the Lord Buddha was quite clear that if you have a job, be thankful and do that job properly to the best of your ability. And then that's the best attitude that you can have as far as work is concerned. So you shouldn't take it for granted, and you should always endeavour to do your best. So they're the six things which lead to ruin. That's the negative. How are we doing for time? I didn't want to start in my... We?
Sorry? 20 minutes of eight.
So, would you like me to continue, or do you want to do some meditation?
Meditation?
Yeah. I've probably talked enough.
Very good, though.
Maybe do you at another time.
Yeah, I think...
I recorded it, so that's...
Oh, thank you, Lorenz.
It was good.
Okay, so let's...
Do we want to start with that, or are we not doing that tonight?
No? Ask the boss.
No Metasutta or Metasutta?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Start with the boss.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the divine abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
The lights. Perfect. Okay, so we've got, what, about 20 minutes left? Let's say 20 minutes.
15?
Yes,
quarter
of. Okay, thank you.
We've got as long as we need.
Okay. So just settle into your seat. Feel yourself comfortable. Move around a little bit if you have to, till you just get to the stage where you feel that you can sit without too much displeasure. Now start your meditation subject. I'm not going to prescribe any particular subject, but if you're not used to meditating, then simply watching the breath, wherever you feel the breath come in and go out, that's the easiest meditation subject to practice. Now, just like last week, what I want you to do, when your mind is focused on your meditation subject, let it just stay there. Let mindfulness be aware that your concentration is anchored on your meditation subject. But if your mind drifts, then acknowledge as soon as you can that the mind has drifted. And then say, what caused this to drift? What is it that's holding me back? What is it that's stopping my mind from becoming concentrated? It's either a wanting for sensory pleasure, or some form of frustration or ill will, or it's some form of laziness, tiredness, or it's some form of worry and anxiety, or it's some form of doubt. They're the five reasons why we can't concentrate. So see which one is affecting you. See whether there's more than one affecting you. See whether they're queuing up at the door to make your mind befuddled. Then when you've identified them, bring your mind back to the meditation subject again. But each time you drift, identify why you've drifted. And then bring your mind with mindfulness back to your meditation subject. So now as we gradually come around, I want you to just focus on that peaceful feeling that you've developed. And as you breathe in, feel the energy that you've generated coming in and focusing down in your body. And as you breathe out, feel that energy flowing right through your body. Breathe energy in. As you breathe out, feel it go through your limbs. Breathe in, focusing that energy. Breathe out, dissipating that energy, spreading that energy in all directions. Just feel yourself now. Just in a calm, peaceful, sublime state. Peace with the world. Gradually open your eyes. And then take up your normal position. Sitting. So, I'm sorry to have cut in so much onto your meditation time and question time, but I guess we covered questions. So, does anyone want to ask anything else before we pack up for the night? Okay, so same time next week. Oh, you want to? No, that's over to the boss.
Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous beings of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may my all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The Sojourner is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
I'll return this to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Thank you.